We'll invite the next panel to come forward. They're also speaking on economic development and what the Utah legislature is doing to make Utah even a more friendly place for growth in economic development. One of the things that the Taxpayers Association has been working on for the last 20 years is removing taxes that are a deterrent to capital investment in the state. We helped to pass the original manufacturing exemption and its expansion in 1996. And one of the things we've been working on since is getting rid of the tax on items that don't have a life of 3 years or more. Those items that have a life of less than 3 years are still taxed on the sales tax. So we're basically punishing industry when they put those kinds of things in place by making them pay almost a 7% tax up front before that equipment is even turned on. One of the good things we have in Utah that makes us one of the best managed states in the nation is that we don't allow delayed fiscal notes on bills. So if you have a spending program that you want to spend something for, you have to make sure that it gets funded. The downside to that is if you want to cut taxes, you also have to find money to replace the taxes as if government deserves everything it's getting today. So we have speaking today with the items listed on your agenda there. First, Senator Stuart Adams, who sponsored a bill this year that didn't make it through, but we hope it makes it through next year, that expands the manufacturing sales tax exemption on items that have less than a three-year life. And then Senator Deidre Henderson is the chair of the Senate Revenue and Taxation Committee. Then Jonathan Ball is at in the Office of Legislative Fiscal Analyst, who will talk to us about dynamic fiscal notes. Take it away.
Thank you, Howard. Appreciate being here. Appreciate your introduction. And I happened to mention to Speaker Hughes as he walked by that the Senate's here to talk about two tax cuts. But anyway, we know in Utah that tax policy drives the economy. And there's no question about it, as we've looked over the past few years, that our tax policy has helped drive the great economy that we have. It's not really takes an economist to figure out that if you tax a business or a job producer in Utah or in any state for that matter more than they're taxed in other states, you make them non-competitive. And right now there are 46 states that have sales tax. There are four that don't have sales tax. Of the 46 states that have sales tax, 40 of them don't tax the inputs that Howard talked about, the parts and other material that these manufacturers use. But only one of those, and Utah is one of those 40 states that don't tax. But of those 40 states that don't tax those inputs, Utah is the only state that taxes inputs less than a three-year life. So those machinery, material, and parts are taxed in Utah with those that have less than a three-year life, and they aren't in other states. Now, we know that as a state, and so we've tried to chip away at this. And on this slide, those industries on the right-hand side, aircraft, pollution control, aerospace, semiconductor, the IM flashes, and they are businesses that we've exempted from that three-year life, and they have a full tax exemption. The businesses in the blue on the left-hand side are the manufacturing facilities and mining establishments and qualified research. Those are the ones that still have that tax on them, that have that non-competitive tax with those 39 other states. In fact, actually 45 of their states. And so we chipped away at it. Last year, I think we took a couple of them. I think the molten magnesium and the drilling equipment, we actually removed that actually last session. But it's very, very hard to actually make those cuts. And so we think we've made a dent. But in fact, the industries in that were on the first slide in that one column are in color on this pie graph, represent only 10% of the industries in Utah. The other 90%, manufacturing and mining, still have that non-competitive tax. And so as we looked at this, we are trying to figure out as to how we might be able to actually make this transition. And one of the things we understand very clearly is that as we remove the tax, we make businesses more competitive, they actually create more jobs. And as they create more jobs, we have more tax revenue. So the effort isn't whether we should do it, just how to do it. And as we've taken historically, as we try to remove the tax, when we actually removed it on manufacturing all products less than a three-year life, we actually phased that in over a period of time. In mining, we actually did that tax cut or gave that tax relief all at once with no phase in. Last year we did, I think, the drilling equipment, we actually did that over a two-year period. The molten magnesium had no phase in. And so as we look out into the future, my hope is that as we look at this bill that we introduced last year, there was a lot of pushback as to how we might be able to actually economically take care of this tax deduction so we could handle that as a state. And my suggestion is that we actually do this over a phase-in process. We do it over time. And that's what I look forward to this next session, and we'll be suggesting and appreciate being here. Thank you.
How embarrassing is it that Stuart and I showed up in the exact same suit? I don't know.
Makes it look a lot better.
You know, last week a colleague of mine related a story in a speech that I heard that I wanted to share with you this morning. He talked about how Vince Lombardi, the famed NFL football coach, the very first team meeting of every football season, he'd gather his players together and he would hold up the ball and he would say, "Gentlemen, this is a football." That story struck me because I feel like sometimes as policymakers, we get a little fancy with our policy and we forget the fundamentals, we forget the basics, the things that are obvious that we should always remember but that are very easy to forget. And as we, Val looked at, you know, showed us how we as a state have been number one in economic outlook for the last 8 years. We've been at the very top in economic competitiveness. And in January, to this very conference, I posed the question, how do we as the state of Utah maintain our competitive edge? What do we do? As states around the country are starting to recognize the error of their ways, they're starting to recognize that their hostile tax policies are actually a disincentive in their states for economic growth. They're starting to change those. 2 years ago, 17 states lowered taxes. Last year, 14 states lowered taxes. This year, New Mexico, Arizona, Washington, D.C., Illinois, and Rhode Island have all lowered their corporate income tax rates. So what are we doing in the state of Utah besides raising taxes? What are we doing to maintain our competitive edge? That's the question that we need to answer. Going back to the fundamentals, I think it's really important for us to remember as we move forward, as we look at policy, what is the purpose of taxation? The purpose of taxation is to raise revenue to fund the government. It's not to control people's behavior. It's not for social engineering. It's not to enrich the poor or to impoverish the rich. It's to raise revenue to fund government, to fund those programs that we as a state deem necessary and important. And the best way to make sure that we have that stable revenue to fund those programs that we as a state feel are necessary and important is to make sure we have a good foundation, a good, solid tax foundation formed with good, solid, sound tax policy. And so as the chair of Revenue and Taxation Committee, we have been tasked this interim with looking at various things. So legislative leadership has asked us to look at certain things. Two of those things are business inputs exemptions and also the corporate income tax structure, corporate income taxes. Earlier this year, I worked with the legislative fiscal analyst. They did some economic modeling for me to see what the benefits of our targeted tax incentive programs are versus what the benefits of an across-the-board corporate income tax cut would be. And hands down, the winner in terms of job creation, in terms of GSP growth, in terms of personal income growth, is an across-the-board corporate income tax cut. You know, corporations ultimately don't pay the taxes that are levied upon them. Those taxes, as we all know, are borne by individuals in the terms of higher prices, in terms of lower wages, and fewer jobs. In fact, the modeling also showed that states with a higher corporate tax burden per person actually had much slower employment growth than states with a lower corporate tax burden per person. So if we're looking at a good foundation for our economy, we need to recognize these principles and the fact that government gets more of what it rewards and less of what it punishes. So what in the state of Utah are we rewarding and what are we punishing? According to the Tax Foundation, last year, Americans paid more in taxes than they did in food, clothing, and housing combined. What are we rewarding in the state of Utah? What are we looking forward to? Are we going to offhand say that we're not going to cut any taxes next year? What does that tell the business community? What does that tell individuals in the state of Utah? I know that those probably weren't the exact words of any of our leaders in the state. But I think that we need to really look at these issues, and we will be this interim. We need to remember Vince Lombardi's football. We need to remember the principles of good, solid tax policy and keep that in the front of our minds moving forward. And that's what we're planning to do in the interim revenue and taxation committee this year. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Ball. I'm the legislative fiscal analyst for Utah. I'm pleased to be here. I'm going to talk to you today about economics and public finance. So now might be a good time for you to check your email or tweet, whatever you'd like to do while I'm talking. I was asked today to talk a little bit about dynamic fiscal notes and how those work, how they compare to our traditional system of fiscal notes, and how the fiscal notes apply to not just revenue bills. This is often comes up with regard to revenue bills, but it's true as well for spending bills. So just let me quickly define a few things for you. So what is a fiscal note? Most of you know what this is, but just quickly. Fiscal note is not a price tag. It's a cost estimate. It's the estimate of implementing a policy, or whether that policy is a tax change or a government program change. It's our estimate for implementing that change. It is, legislators don't necessarily have to pay that estimate. Of course, it's good management to do so, to recognize those costs. And the timing of when you recognize those costs is really the issue here. What we do is static fiscal notes in Utah. A static fiscal note basically says, in the case of a revenue bill, take the tax base times the rate, and that gets you the fiscal impact. Of course, that's an oversimplification. Many of you have probably heard about Congress's recent change to dynamic scoring, to the CBO's change to dynamic scoring at the national level. Something similar to that for us would be a dynamic fiscal note, where we recognize not just the direct impact of a policy change, but the indirect and induced impacts. So while a static fiscal note just takes rate times base, a dynamic fiscal note would look at the rate times the base, but then would also consider a number of other things, like what happens as a result of this change in tax policy? What happens due to elasticity? What happens due to behavior change? And how does that impact the economy? And then how do you reflect those things in the fiscal note? So we would measure the base change, the revenue change, the tax rate times the base. We would measure the change in spending in the economy as a result of that. We would convert behavioral responses into economic activity. The benefits of dynamic fiscal note is they're probably more accurate. They're arguably more relevant because they are looking at real-world responses and not just an academic exercise. They are a higher risk because we're making assumptions about human behavior changes, and those are very hard things for economists to try to predict. And then the final column here talks about cost-benefit analysis. Fiscal notes, we don't measure benefits in fiscal notes. We measure costs. So if you really want to look at the total benefit to society and individuals from a policy change like a tax cut, you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, and that's what the last column talks about. So a dynamic fiscal note has really two big components. The first one is the multiplier effect, and you all know what a multiplier is, right? If you take the total change in the economy as a result of a policy change and you divide it by the initial change, that gives you your multiplier. So for example, if you reduce a tax, let's say from 10% to 5%, that sounds like a revenue loss to government. It is also, to Senator Stevenson's point, a cost savings to business, right? So the cost savings to business then could be invested in the economy. The economy would change. If you take that initial change in the rate or the cost to business and divide it into the economic activity, that's your multiplier. We hear lots and lots of stories about multipliers that are 30x and 40x, you know, 100x. We're going to get 100 times back what we are saving. If you can find one of those, I've got some oceanfront property here in Salt Lake that I'd like to sell you as well. Multipliers, you're lucky if you get 3x. You're really lucky if you get three times on a multiplier. So you have to think about that in terms of taxes. I use that 10% to 5%. If you have a 10% flat tax and you reduce it to 5%, you have to have a 20x multiplier to make back your revenue loss, right? And so in most cases, this is just to say, dynamic fiscal notes will not pay for, in terms of revenue or cost, will not pay for a policy change. But that doesn't mean the policy change is good or bad, because you have another effect, and that is you have job creation, you have wealth creation, you have income creation, right? There are opportunity costs to every decision we make. So this is a picture of me and my dog. This is maybe I'm dreaming, because it says, I hope you appreciate that each walk costs $175 of my billable time. So that's like a 20-hour walk for me. And the dog says, I hope you appreciate that I'm your only friend. So the opportunity cost of the walk for the guy is $175, but the upside is he has a friend at least. So you have to think about both of these things. What are the revenue impacts, as well as what are the opportunity costs, and what's the upside for a policy change? We have, and this is another example of that. Production possibilities frontier. Basically, if you have a policy that moves you from the bottom of this frontier, so that line represents our total capacity, in this case, for jobs in the state. This is theoretical. Those aren't real numbers. But in essence, if you are all the way down at the bottom at 50 jobs for your given revenue, you could move along the frontier and get more jobs up at the top. That's a valid policy choice. That's a valid trade-off. Okay. I think ideally what we want to do with tax policy, though, is we want to move that production possibility frontier out so that you can create more jobs all along that spectrum. And so those are all things that we would want to address in a dynamic fiscal note. So when we do dynamic fiscal notes, we've done a few of these. We present four scenarios. The one is the do-nothing scenario. What happens with that? Second scenario is what if we just spend the money in government? What does that look like? The third one is then, okay, what if we don't spend the money in government and we give it back? What does that create in the economy? Assuming no behavioral response, assuming there's not a huge change in behavior on behalf of investors and businesses. And the final one is, well, what if they do change their behavior dramatically? What does that look like? We did one for the manufacturer's exemption on 3-year and less inputs. We did this 2 years ago, and this is basically what it looks like. And you can see that what we tried to show on these dynamic fiscal notes is the baseline at the top. So that first line shows you what is the static impact. And in this case, the first scenario is the do nothing. If you don't spend this $30 million, that's how much revenue we were assuming that we would lose in state government. If you don't do it, if you don't spend that money and you don't give it back, what happens with it? It goes in the bank, it earns interest. That's the second line down. That's the dynamic impact. So that's scenario one. You can see not a huge difference because we're earning like 45 basis points on the PTIF right now. No jobs, no wages, no GDP. Look at scenario two, which is, well, what if we spend the money in state government? What happens there? So you take the $30 million, you get it, surprisingly, you do get a little bit of return because teachers buy washers and dryers too. So you get a little bit of dynamic response there. Not a ton, and you get some jobs, and you get wages, and you get GDP. The really exciting part, I think, comes when you start then looking at, well, what are the other alternatives? So scenario three says, what if you give this $30 million back to manufacturers? What happens there? How much less revenue do you lose over time, if you're looking at it from that perspective? So you compare those first two lines. But then more importantly, how many jobs are created, how much in wages is created, and how much GDP do you generate? These are all valid policy decisions, and I think that's what Senator Stevenson was saying about governments assuming that it's their money. We have two parties in Utah. We have two parties in Utah, the House and the Senate. That's especially true in my role, so I don't want to talk about tax cuts versus tax increases at all. But as far as I'm concerned, it's all taxpayer money, even if you do collect it in revenue. But you might do so for a valid reason, or you might give it back for a valid reason, like creating jobs and GDP. And that's kind of what we want to reflect in these dynamic notes is there's a flip side to the revenue loss, and we want to show that on the fiscal note. And then the final scenario here, this is not just businesses reinvest this tax savings in the economy and don't change their behavior, but the bottom line shows if they have this savings, are they likely to match it with other investments? Are they likely to expand here or move here and bring more resources, more capital to the state? And if they are likely to do that, what does that look like? And so that's sort of the ultimate fiscal note from a revenue policy perspective. Shows the baseline, shows the dynamic response, jobs, wages, and GDP created. And you can see it still doesn't pay for itself, right? Even out there in your fiscal year 15, from a government revenue perspective, it still doesn't pay for itself. But it's dramatically lower. The cost is dramatically lower than it would have been otherwise. So that's all I have. Thank you.